What if the book you wrote became an international bestseller and was adapted into a blockbuster Hollywood movie? That's exactly what happened to Matt Bondurant, a college professor and author of The Wettest County in the World. Matt's book will be adapted into the hit film Lawless, starring Shia LaBeouf and Tom Hardy. Join us as we talk about Matt's incredible journey from writing books to walking the red carpet on this episode of The Rod Kirby Show. Hey, and welcome to The Rod Kirby Show. I'm your host, Rod Kirby, and today I have a very special guest, Mr. Matt Bondurant. Matt is an international best-selling author. He's best known for the book, The Wettest County in the World, which was actually turned into a film. You may have heard of it. It's called Lawless, which is on Netflix right now. Matt, thank you for joining me, and welcome to the show, man. How you doing?
Thanks, Rod. Glad to be here. Doing great.
Matt, it's so good to have you on the show, and you know, a lot of people know of your book, and they know, of course, of the movie Lawless. What was it like to actually go to the red carpet premiere of that film once it was actually made?
Well, it was pretty exciting. I had never done anything like that. I hadn't anticipated participating in something like that. And the producers of the film were generous enough, kind enough to fly my wife and I out there. The rest of my family went out there too. They put us up, you know, in a really nice hotel. It was for about 2 days. It was like a total star treatment situation.
Right.
It felt awesome. It felt great.
Yeah.
The red carpet itself was, it's surprisingly, it was a lot like it looks like on TV and things. I mean, it was, you know, I'm on there with like Shia LaBeouf and some of these other actors, and we're they introduce you. And one of the really cool things is that my whole family, including my father, were able to be inside the theater for the thing. Yeah. And my dad was on the red carpet. He's got pictures of him and, Shia LaBeouf, and you know, who plays his father in the film.
Yeah.
It was really sort of an exciting opportunity for my family. There was an after party event, which was pretty wild, pretty cool. For a couple of days, it was kind of a whirlwind experience of kind of that LA Hollywood thing. But that goes away pretty quick. back home in the reality, but
right. Well, for those that aren't familiar with your book, The Wettest County in the World, I know it's based on a true story, based upon your father's father. Am I right in saying that?
Yeah.
Your father's father and his brothers in the good old days of being sober in America, forcefully sober in America. What was the book kind of generally about for people that aren't familiar with it?
Well, it's basically about these three brothers in Virginia in the 1920s and 30s who, in a county, Franklin County, Virginia, who were moonshiners and bootleggers to a degree, and a large sort of countywide conspiracy, a racketeering scheme, was put into effect by the Commonwealth's attorney, and they were one of the moonshiners who sort of refused to go along. Law enforcement was in on it, so they started this antagonistic relationship. People were, there were some violent episodes, attempts on their lives.
Wow,
some people were killed, and culminating with this kind of shootout at a bridge in December of 1930 with some law enforcement agents and my grandfather and his brothers. I tried to sort of tell the true story of these guys and how they came to be in that situation and what it was like. And also a big part of the book is the character Sherwood Anderson, who's an American writer who was there doing a story about these brothers and the kind of mythology around them.
Right.
He was doing it a few years later. So the book, big departure from the movie, the book has two timelines. You have the Sherwood Anderson timeline, which is a few years later, and he's sort of trying to discover. I mean, he's the detective, so to speak, the journalist who's trying to figure out what's going on, what happened. And then we also have the timeline of the three brothers, going through the actual events.
Wow. That's awesome, man. Well, and then the book was basically adapted into a film starring Tom Hardy and Shia LaBeouf and a whole host of other, A-list celebrities and actors. So let's take a look at the trailer for the film, and then we'll come back and discuss, okay?
Like to come for rob me sometime.
I know who you are.
Oh yeah, who's that?
One of them Bondurant boys. My daddy says you boys are the worst thing ever to hit Franklin.
You t- tell your daddy I said hi.
We got a chance to make a good stack of money here.
Pure corn whiskey, so white lightning.
Come on, Forrest, see you dance.
I ain't dancing for you, too.
Come on.
It's impressive.
I respect you, Bonnie Rance.
You want any more of this stuff?
As much as you can bring me.
That's $2,000, minus my commission.
Look at you, swanning around like you're Al Capone.
They say in town you're looking for someone to help out around the place. Well, Mr. Bondrin, do I get the job?
Seems you've been involved in certain illegal activities.
There's a new special deputy. Been brought in from the city. Wants to work it out so everybody can do some business. That's all.
I'm the one who's going to make your life real difficult from now on if you don't toe the line, country boy.
I'm a Bondurant. We don't lay down for nobody.
Those men that attacked you, they work for dangerous people.
There's a feeling around these parts that these Bondurants is indestructible.
Do you mean immortal? You any idea what a Thompson submachine gun does to a mortal?
Survivors. We control the fear. But without the fear, we are all as good as dead.
This is a war they're waging. You ain't gonna survive.
It is not the violence that sets men apart. It is the distance that he is prepared to go.
All right, that was the trailer for Lawless. Does that take you back? Do you give you some memories?
It does, yeah. It's weird. I haven't seen that in a long time. And so, yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. Well, you know, I want people to understand that you're not just a writer and author. You're actually a screenwriter as well. You've written three original screenplays that have sold as well. And I want to get to those in just a moment, but take us back to when you were actually developing the book for The What Is Counting the World. And the process from getting the book into being adapted into a screenplay, how did that all play out?
You know, I heard about the story, you know, decades ago, you know, or parts of the story. And so I really started working on it after I published my first book, which was in 2005. Mm-hmm. And so I started working more in earnest. My dad already had a lot of research on it. So, and I knew it was a cool story. And the research, the historical aspect of it was fascinating.
Right.
I had a feeling that it would resonate as a good book. I was mostly just terrified of how to put it together. The Sherwood Anderson character in that timeline and how to manage that. And I wasn't thinking about film rights or anything like that. Really. I mean, you think about film rights. I think a lot of writers, in a kind of general way, like, oh, mm-hmm. I hope they sell them.
Right.
Because it'd be nice to get a check for that, but you don't really think it's going to get made, you know, because people sell film rights all the time, and you know, because producers and studios will buy film rights and just hang on to them forever, or they'll buy, you know, like say a movie is being made and it looks like it might be popular, they'll buy up the film rights of a whole bunch of books that are kind of similar, just in case, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes they'll buy it so other people can't do it, you know.
That's true.
And so either way, you know, it's not. It's all pretty good for the writer because you still get paid for it, so that's all fine. when we had an advanced reader's copy, the agent sends it around. It started getting passed around L.A. really early. Attracted attention. I think it attracts attention because of the historical story and also that it's based on my grandfather. I mean, that's an automatic kind of little buzz to it.
Yeah.
So it started going around, and there were a couple different actors. So then we sold the film rights rather quickly, it was a great deal for me. I was totally thrilled to have it happen, and then soon after they started to different actors were sort of became attached. The director John Hillcoat was a driving force behind it from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. You know, he had just done The Road. he had done the Australian Western, The Proposition, which is a great film too. So he'd already done some great films, was attracting a lot of attention, and he wanted to do kind of a, he was fascinated by the idea of these kind of Western, but in Appalachia, kind of a Appalachian Western sort of style thing.
Yeah.
And his brand is kind of, you know, kind of gritty realism, and you know, a lot of, so it lined up well with what I was doing. So he was kind of a driving force behind it. And actually the actor Shia LaBeouf was signed on from the very beginning.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Like he saw it as a role, as a solid role. This is, you know, after like the Transformer films and things.
Oh yeah.
This is right when he wanted to become more of a serious, you know,
right.
And you know, he's done plenty of roles now, but this was one of his first kind of more serious roles after the Transformer stuff. So he was looking for something that was, you know, kind of meaty and independent.
Right.
Yeah. And so originally it was at Columbia, and there were, so it was Shia LaBeouf, and then they had Scarlett Johansson. They had, you know, a variety of, what's his name? What's the really attractive dude from, he was in La La Land, the blonde.
Oh, Ryan Gosling?
Gosling was attached to it at one point to play Forrest, you know?
Yeah.
Which, you know, this is all great. I mean, they're just telling, you know, the agents are just sort of contacting me like, oh, these people are attached now. Great. I don't even know what that really means.
Right.
And then it kind of stalls, and it goes into what they call turnaround, where they, you know, where basically Columbia wants to unload it.
Yeah.
And these other, a sort of consortium of independent film producers, including like Red Wagon and Megan Ellison, you know, Annapurna from, you know, who do great films. So a collection of them kind of got together. And then Tom Hardy at the time was doing Mad Max in
Fury Road.
Yeah. And there was a series of floods, storms, and they had to shut down production down there for like 6 weeks, 8 weeks.
Oh, wow.
Like
that. Yeah.
And so, you know, his agent, they were like, hey, there's this script, there's this thing. And he was like, okay, I'll go do that. So he flies, you know.
Nice.
And they're all doing it for like minimum pay. I know Shia LaBeouf got like $35,000 for it.
Really?
Like which I think is the lowest amount you can get paid.
Yeah.
For the union or whatever.
For SAG,
so yeah, I think they were interested. I think they liked the script and all that. Obviously, Nick Cave, you know, put together a script. They liked that, but they also wanted to work with John Hillcoat. I think was a big deal.
Yeah.
So Tom Hardy goes over, and then it's, you know, at this time, Tom Hardy was a huge commodity or like a hot, you know. Yeah. So Jessica Chastain jumps in, and then Guy Pearce,
Gary Oldman.
They were able to. Really, Tom Hardy was like a magnet. I think they kind of pulled it together. And they had a short shooting schedule that allowed him to kind of get it done in the middle of the Mad Max film. And that's really, that's really how it kind of came together.
It's timing right there.
Yeah. Very, I mean, just luck. I mean, I talk to my students all the time about there's so much luck, and especially when it comes to film, whether the film rights get bought, because all it needs is like one producer or somebody who gets eyes on it. And it's like, oh yeah, I want that. And then the same thing with the films being made. I mean, I have lots of friends, and I know lots of authors who have sold film rights, but their books have never been made to a film. And those books would have been great films, you know. It's just random stuff like that. So I really got just kind of really lucky that that had happened. But I mean, Hillcoat and Shia LaBeouf, you know, a lot of responsibility for really kind of keeping the thing alive and sticking with it. Yeah.
Did you have any input into the screenplay?
I did in like a sort of an unofficial capacity. Advice, you know, in my contract, I didn't really have any kind of power over anything, you know, but they, you know, there was language in there about being an advisor, you know, and things like that. And so basically just out of the kindness of their heart, but also, you know, Hillcoat, all along Hillcoat liked the book, and he wanted to stay close to the book, and he wanted to stay close to the story as much as possible. You know, he wanted it to be real and authentic and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So they, you know, they were interested in what I had to say and what I had to, I don't think they were just doing it to be nice. They didn't have to include me at all, really. But Yeah, I mean, I talked to Nick Cave a few times. You know, they showed me versions of the script. You know, I made little comments, but, you know, I understand, you know, Nick Cave was getting contracted to create something from the book. And it that's his project, you know, that's his art, you know. Mm-hmm. I wrote the book, and so I wasn't trying to get up in his business about really how to do it. Yeah. And also because at that time I had never written a screenplay myself, and I barely looked at any, so I didn't even know what I was really, you know, I didn't really know what I was looking at. I'm looking at the dialogue, and I noticed there's a lot of dialogue in there that's directly from the book. I'm like, that's great.
It's a different process, though, isn't it? To kind of go from prose writing to screenwriting, right?
Yes, definitely. Definitely.
But, that time, though, you've sold three screenplays. So what's changed in that period of time?
Man, I don't know. I think a lot of it is there's a lot of luck involved. I was able to basically the agents and people were able to use the film as kind of a springboard. I immediately was getting lots of interest from people in LA, you know, different producers and directors and stuff who wanted to meet with me. You know, I was flying out to LA a lot, and I would be, you know, in this rental car, just like going to like five meetings a day. I'm like driving up to some dude's house in like the canyon, you know, and like sitting by the pool, and he's like, pitch me some ideas, you know. And I didn't know anything about any, in fact, I didn't even know how to pitch anything. And I didn't even know I was supposed to be pitching things, really. I mean, I figured that out soon, but the first couple I was at, I was like, you mean you want like an idea, like a new idea for a TV show or movie? And they're like, yeah. I'm like, you know, I didn't really have that many ideas. And I'm not one of these writers or artists that has like multiple ideas going on. I have like one good idea at a time.
That's me too.
Yeah. And I stick with it for like 3 years. But I mean, the thing is that gave me a lot of chances. It gave me a lot of opportunities. And also when they were like, you know, producers were like, can you do something like this? Can you, like, for example, the first one I did with HBO and Cinemax, basically people were telling me like, we want something that's, cause remember Homeland was a huge show at the time. And they were like, we want something like Homeland, but not Homeland, but like Homeland, you know? So it's some kind of, and police procedural stuff. I don't even watch those, you know, I mean, those shows. I mean, I've never even seen an episode of CSI. I'm just not that really drawn to police stuff, much less CIA or whatever. But, you know, I'd seen movies, and I watched Homeland the first couple seasons. So, I mean, I had to figure something, and they wanted it in New York. When I say they, I'm talking about like my agent and some other people. I don't know. Right. So I had a leg, you know, I had an in, you know, already. Mm-hmm. And so they were like, okay, write a pilot. And I was like, I don't even know how to do that. And they're like, okay, well get final draft, you know.
Step one, final draft.
Step one. So I bought that, and then they're like, "Here's a whole bunch of screenplays." You know, they sent me a whole bunch of stuff, of shows, and you know, I mean, like stuff from like Sopranos or Breaking Bad. You know, big shows.
Yeah.
And so I got to read a lot of those, and I was like, okay, I think I see what's going on, and you know, then I had to come up with something. So I had to come up with some kind of thing, and you know, the thing I came, you know, it was sort of about the NSA in New York, and it had to do with like this this sort of secret society that was ooh, part of the original Dutch settlers of New York, and then it had to do with 9/11 and terrorism and stuff. You know, so it was pretty cool. It had something in it.
Yeah.
But you know, I was just kind of making it, winging it. Yeah. And then we go the other thing. I had the luxury of people were willing to allow me to pitch it to them. You know, I got these meetings, and so then it started a series of, I'm flying out there, and we go to like two or three places a day, studios. We went to all the major studios, and we're pitching them these things, and you know, where I practiced doing it, you know. So I kind of learned how to pitch, like actually doing it,
you right know, on the job training. There you go,
on the job. Yeah. And it was scary.
A bit.
Yeah, it was weird. And, it, you know, it, the worst part of it, though, really, as people will tell, I'm sure anybody who's done this, is that, you know, you're in a lot of these meetings and like you can tell it's just not really working and they're not that interested, but you kind of have to just get through this. And then they're like next one, you know, next. So, but I mean, but the people at HBO and Cinemax, they were intrigued. You know, it was one of the few meetings we had a couple where they were like interested, and Cinemax in particular was interested because they were just starting to build, you know, shows, you know, like they wanted to, you know, get in that like Showtime and HBO were doing.
Yeah.
And scripted dramas and 1 hour dramas. So they bought it and, you know, set me up with a development deal where I was a producer. And then we started the long, tedious process of revision, you know, so I'm doing all these phone conference calls with HBO and Cinemax executives, basically. And, it was an interesting process. We did it for like 6 months. I mean, the script, the script basically changed radically by, you know, after like 3 months, it was almost a whole different thing.
Yeah.
And then like by the end, it was kind of coming back around to almost where we started. And a lot of my struggle was I couldn't quite give them what they wanted, I think, because in particular, they wanted something, especially because the Cinemax, I mean, you know, you know what Cinemax does, and so they wanted something a little more pulpy for the Cinemax side of things. You know what I mean? It wasn't HBO, it was Cinemax. So, you know, they wanted like, are we allowed to curse on this thing, Rob?
Yeah, go right ahead.
You know, they wanted people like fucking like right away. You know, they wanted stuff happening. They wanted people like, they wanted violence and sex and you know, boom, boom, boom. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I do a little bit of that, you know, but I don't do a whole lot of the sex part. And so, I think my thing was to, you know, I was trying to do something more like Breaking Bad or something a little more interesting and
kind of prestige. More,
just something. Yeah, and so they I couldn't quite give them that that thing, and so eventually they just let it go. You know, we just stopped. And the thing that I kind of learned from this is that the you know, these producers and executives for these networks, they don't really know what they want. I mean, I think they have a general idea, but what it is that they know when they see it,
right?
You know, like that, but they don't know what to tell you. Like if it's not what they want, they just start throwing out other things, other ideas, and so that it's a difficult and process because it's all this conference calls and it's all these people talking to you. And I'm used to, as a novelist, I'm used to just going into my hole, doing my thing. Mm-hmm. So having all this input and suggestions, and it was interesting, but after a while it's like, you guys are searching for something and I'm just going to maybe luckily hit upon it.
Right.
But otherwise we're just going to keep doing this forever. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, it was a good deal. You know, they paid me well. I was happy to do it. I would do it again. But, you know, ultimately it was a fruitless task. We couldn't quite get it going. So
let's hypothetical here. If you were just starting out all over again with the screenwriting process and let's say you had, you know, unlimited budget to do whatever you want to do, whatever your mind could create. What three steps would you take to ensure that you would have a successful screenplay?
I think number one would have to be, reading lots of good scripts. I think, you've got to read.
Yeah.
You know, you take a show, like Breaking Bad, like that pilot, which is just an excellent pilot. And that's one of the few, things that I read. Script where I was like, this is good, you know, like the script is good.
Yeah.
And I was interested in the script, you know. Mm-hmm. A lot of scripts, even for shows that I like, the script is kind of, you know, it's not that exciting. I mean, you're imagining it maybe as a show and you're like, okay, I see how this works, but I don't know. I think it's hard to kind of grab somebody with just the script, you know.
Yeah.
And this is why people do what do they call them, the reels, teaser reels, you know. You shoot a little piece of something,
proof of concept.
I could see how that's very effective because sometimes it doesn't really just come off the page right away. So, I mean, I would, number one is I would want to look at a lot of scripts. I don't know. It's hard to say if I would recommend some kind of program or a program of study or mm-hmm. film school or something like that. I do think it's important to get people to read your stuff. You know, I think if you had a network of people, mm-hmm. I mean, I might say number two is move to LA. I mean, because, you know, as a person who's long distance, you know, I think it matters. I mean, I think I probably could have had more jobs or done more things if I was there, if I could have mm-hmm. shown up. But I think it's getting better and better for long distance stuff.
Yeah. And then the general community in Atlanta is bigger as well. So you're a little closer because you're in Oxford, Mississippi right now.
Yeah. Yeah. That's another thing. Atlanta and you know, New York, obviously. I mean, I think there's a few hubs that I would want to try to, because it, you know, knowing people and being around and just showing up places, you know, that stuff matters.
Being able to network.
Yeah. Networking. And I only like networking, but I mean, I get it. You know, if you're around and you show up and, mm-hmm. and then the last thing would be, and this is why maybe I'm hesitant about programs and stuff, because in my experience, you know, somebody who was basically sort of self-taught, mm-hmm. but who has since, I mean, I looked at, you know, some of the books, you know, the Sid, what's his name's, you know,
Sid Meier's screenplay. Yeah,
the famous books.
Yep, Sid the Cat.
Yeah, and you know, and I've looked at stuff online, people that mm-hmm. have classes, and you know, I've looked at a lot of that stuff, and I don't know, in my experience, I think I did better by kind of not paying attention to that stuff, mm-hmm. and not instead what I was focused on was coming up with a premise that mm-hmm. that had some kind of angle on it that was intriguing, like immediate, like, you know, take Breaking Bad for example. I mean, the show is sold because it's a chemistry teacher who's going to make meth because he's got cancer. I mean, you know,
right,
all the rest of the stuff, which is great, comes after that. But I mean, you got to sell that premise first. And so, you know, people were just writing all these scripts that are like another cop show or another doctor show mm-hmm. or whatever, or, you know, maybe the doctor is, you know, this kind of person or something, you know, okay. I was more into like a little higher concept, a little more dramatically different.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm going to do lots of, description. I mean, not a ton, because you know how you're not supposed to have too much of
all right
that, yeah mm-hmm. stuff, but I was like, I'm gonna, because like in Breaking Bad and a couple other the good ones, like The Wire, there's ways you can be evocative and interesting, use mm-hmm. your skills as a writer,
yeah,
in those stage directions and things like that, you know what I mean, you can kind of convey. And so I was trying to make the script interesting to read, just because a lot of the scripts, you know, it's very simple, you know, and that's what gets made a lot. I understand, I get that. But I was like, no, I'm going to try to do it, make it strange, you know, like this is a different kind of show, you know, mm-hmm. like True Detective, like Pizzolatto did in that show. You know, the script is just odd and interesting. And so that was intriguing to me. So, you know, maybe the advice, the thing that I would advise is to like, don't worry so much about satisfying the market. Instead, try to do the thing that you think is interesting. You know,
right.
Like do the weird. And I like kind of strange stuff with these different kinds of concepts to it. I wanted, like, especially TV, movie, that's what I'm attracted to.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to do that. And so in a way, I think my advice is kind of, you know, be aware of the industry standards and what, you know, what everybody's doing, what people advise, but then try to cut away from that, you know what I mean, like
right,
do something different, because I mean, you know, it's such a crapshoot, and you're just gonna have to, you're just trying to get somebody's attention just for a second, mm-hmm. and so putting something in there that's kind of like, whoa, you know, and you know, take a shot, and that's I don't know, that's probably the best advice I have.
Yeah, I love it, man. So definitely read more scripts, because you don't know how to write a good screenplay unless you read a good one, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which makes a lot of sense. And of course, if you're not in LA or anywhere near the hubs, the major film hubs, definitely get out there and network and meet new people, meet people that can help you advance your career and people that you can help advance theirs as well.
Yeah.
And then of course, as you said, you know, you don't have to always play by the rules. You know, but there is one thing though, if you're brand new to screenwriting, and if you're trying to enter screenplay competitions and such, you have to kind of play by the rules, because the people that are judging those, they really want that to be formatted correctly. They want to see that you adhere to, showing the story, not just telling the story, and all these different rules that are set up. But if you look at the market, if you look at Tarantino, if you look at just about any other major director, they kind of play by their own rules, and they can do that. Of course, they've got millions of makes. Of course, they can do that. But if you want to stand out there, out from the crowd, you have to kind of give it, a different taste, a different flavor. Give it more direction. I love it. It's great advice. Yeah.
It's a weird business, because it's such a crapshoot. I mean, writing novels and publishing books is very similar in that you're kind of just tossing this thing into a void, mm-hmm. and you're just hoping one person happens to get eyes on it, and they're mm-hmm. like, oh. But great scripts will just float around and get nothing. Great books, go out there and nobody wants them. I mean, frustrating. I mean, I really, especially for screenplay writers, because, there's a lot of them, and there's a lot of people out there trying to get in that door. And it's a tough business, real tough business.
Yeah, it's a lot of competition, and like you said, there's a lot of people that are, everyone you meet in LA, they're all trying to sell a screenplay or be in a movie. Yeah. But that's why you have to stand out, and you have to really just take what's in your mind and put it out there. And that's why I encourage a lot of people to not only write spec scripts based on properties, but also write your own ideas, get your own stuff out there and promote yourself, and pretty much be your best own cheerleader to get your own stuff out there.
Yeah. And to produce stuff. I mean, people have said, if you want to make movies, the best thing to do is to make a movie, and that's absolutely what you do that. I mean, you're like shoot stuff, and you're putting together reels of things. And I think if you're just, you want to put together screenplays, if you want to be a screenplay, hook up with somebody and get something shot, right. start making, low budget short films with your great, screenplay, great dialogue and things. And then that's how you can, get people's attention.
And I'm actually glad you mentioned that, because I have a brand new blog post on my website. It is called How to Make a Low Budget Movie with 5 Tips for Success. And it's at rodkirby.com. Go check that out. Brand new blog post. I did put that out there actually on yesterday, which today is the second. I put it out there on December 1st. So it's based on the interview I had with filmmaker Jessica B. Smith, who pretty much did the same thing. And she had a script that was actually held hostage by BET Network. They actually held on to it for 6 months. It was under consideration for development, and then they passed on it. But she made it anyway, which was pretty awesome. So check that out. It's pretty cool.
I'm going to read that myself.
Please do.
I want to make a film, a low-budget movie.
Man, whenever you are ready, let me know, okay? I got you.
It's just so much work.
It is a lot of work, but, it's awesome to see it come to fruition, especially when you've put your own time, your own money. And I actually just talked to a filmmaker. His name is Anwar Jameson. He did a film called Coming to Africa, which is actually making its debut, its theatrical debut in Africa, in Ghana, this week. So he produced it. It had a production in Ghana, and then that half production was in Memphis, Tennessee. And he put his own money into it. No investors. He spent, upwards of $100,000, his own money. And he's living out his own dream, which is amazing. So it's definitely a challenge being an independent filmmaker, but it's so rewarding, when you can just see your ideas come to life.
Yeah. And that's one of the big central differences between being a writer and being an independent film, like say trying to write a novel.
Yeah.
The independent filmmaker, you got to come up with money. You have to ask, you have to get people to give you money.
Right.
Or whatever. You got to get some money together. Whereas, mm-hmm. Writer, you got to pay for your living, but you can kind of sit in your own little room and just, crank it out yourself. And so, I mean, I have a lot of respect, man, for independent filmmakers that are just out there grinding, just out there mm-hmm. doing it, getting money together, putting out stuff. And, it happens, people, people put out little projects, it gets noticed, maybe it's festival stuff, and then all of a sudden you're getting other jobs, and then all of a sudden you get a feature, you know what I mean? That's the way it works. So
Mr. Matt, what else are you working on? Are you writing anything new?
Yeah, I mean, I've got a book coming out in June. Okay. The new novel, it's called Oleander City. And it's, I think people who liked Wettis County will like it a lot. It's another historical novel. It's based on a true story about the Galveston hurricane in 1900 and the immediate aftermath. So it's a lot of boxing, the Jack Johnson, the boxer.
Okay.
Yeah. Who's from Galveston, who was in Galveston at the time. They set up a boxing match with, this other guy, as a way to raise funds for the recovery effort.
Oh, nice.
You know, Jack Johnson at the time, he was only 19 years old, so he only had a couple fights, but and they brought in this this veteran boxer, Joe Kowinski, who was pretty much the greatest Jewish boxer of all time. And he was kind of, you know, on the downhill side of his career, so he was one of the few guys that would, you know, cross the color line, that would fight a black boxer,
right?
You know. So he goes down there and he, you know, immediately after the fight, in the fight was, you know, controversial, a variety of reasons, but they get arrested and they get thrown in jail for breaking a prize fight laws. And also, you know, it had a lot to do with the fact that Jack Johnson was already kind of a notorious figure.
Yeah.
People down there didn't like him. You know, he was like hanging around with white women and all, you know, doing stuff he wasn't supposed to be doing. And they brought this guy in because they wanted him, you know, knocked out. And so they go to jail together, and they're in jail for about almost 4 weeks. And while they're in jail, they're sparring and they're doing stuff because the sheriff is charging admission. People are coming in charging admission to see these guys box, because the Jewish boxer Joe Kowinski was pretty popular. He was a known, you know, like a known veteran. People knew him. And then, so when they get out, Jack Johnson, you know, said several times that it was that those weeks in the jail cell that really taught him how to box.
Wow.
And he goes on to win like his next 30 fights in a row, becomes the greatest heavyweight boxer of all time.
Well, I'm definitely looking forward to that. That actually sounds like it would make a good movie. Hint, hint, wink, wink.
Uh-huh. Sure. I just hope we sell those rights, you know. Be nice.
Well, you know what? I mean, honestly, I mean, you can do it, man. You got the rights. You are the author. You are the owner. I know you want to do a studio movie, of course, and get that bigger paycheck, of course.
Yeah.
But if you want to do a short film or something like that, let me know. I got you.
I got you. Yeah, man, definitely.
Matt, I want to thank you for joining me today. And everyone that's watching, I want you all to go to Matt's website. It's mattbondurant.com. For more information on his books, as well as what he's working on. And you can contact Matt, or you can connect with him on Facebook. There you go. It's Matt Bondurant fan page right there on Facebook. And of course, for me, you can follow me on rodkirby.com, as well as all social platforms to Rod Kirby. Thank you all for joining us. And Matt, thank you again, sir. Appreciate you. You have to come back and tell us how your next screenplay is going to be doing.
Thanks, Rod. Appreciate it.
All right, everyone. Have a good one. Take care. Hey, filmmaker Rod Kirby here. Thanks for tuning into this episode. If you're enjoying the podcast, do me a favor and give me a review on Apple Podcasts. If you're not on Apple Podcasts, don't worry about that. Just follow on your favorite podcast app and stay tuned for more filmmaking content. Thanks again, and I'll see you all in the next episode.